it's absolutely fantastic to have Chris with us again to talk about that period leading up to the Battle of Passchendaele and what the New Zealand Division was up to. So without further ado...
Bloody October, and ironically, that photo was taken when they handed out the first copies of the 1917 edition of New Zealanders at the Front. And it seemed to me enormously ironic. There's the stretcher party who are absolutely buggered. And then you zero in on that guy and it sums up Passchendaele. Because on the 12th of October, an infantryman, standard carry somewhere between 58 to 68 pounds per soldier. Stretcher bearers stripped back, but an infantryman would take in the Passchendaele mud between Gravenstaffel and the front line forward 4 hours a mile to get a wounded man on a stretcher back from Waterloo Farm to the nearest point where either a horse-drawn or motor vehicle ambulance could pick him up at Spree Farm would take 8 hours for 8 men. And after the 12th, between the 12th and the 14th, there were 1,000 men from the Reserve New Zealand Brigade plus 1,400 men from one of the British brigades, basically 2,500 men. It took them 2 days to clear the wounded. And of course, the critical thing is gas gangrene sets in if he's not back at a station being treated within 24 hours. So most of them, in fact, were out there for 3 days, and it speaks for itself. So to me, he's the face of Passchendaele. But I digress. Let's get on with it. Okay. The key question that fascinates me is the mud and the blood clouds us. Passchendaele is such an emotive term that why Passchendaele? What was it, just a rush of blood to the head for Haig? And if you look at that map and the detail you won't see, but there's Ypres. And you get a sense of the salient by those dotted lines. And note the high ground. High ground, 100 metres above sea level. And as you'll see in some of the photos to come, but in terms of a German advance that way, or over time, or a French or a Spanish advance the other way, that high ground is critically important. And that becomes the salient and the battle. And there's Passchendaele. And by 1917, it doesn't exist. It's brick dust in the mud. And there's Messines, a prelude to Passchendaele, which I'll talk to in a moment. And there's Ostend, German U-boat base controlling controlling the entrance to the channel. And the reason why the Admiralty approaches Haig and says, you need to take the U-boat ports on the Belgium coast. And so the prompt isn't Haig's, because it's the Admiralty. Because at this point, unrestricted submarine campaign, losing too many ships, and war is logistics and communications. And so Haig assesses the ground, and oops, you see this tiny little red line. That's Staten, Lula. It's a railway line. And it's a very important railway line because in any war, logistics, supplies, ammunition, reinforcements, and in the First World War, fodder, the amount of room that fodder takes up for the horses. New Zealand Division, 3,800 horses for an infantry division. And that was typical. And so Haig assesses that if he can cut the Staten Waller railway line, the Germans have to retire back to that line there, which puts Ostend, the major base, first major base, in the front line, and rules out it being used as a U-boat base. And so there's the genesis of the Passchendaele Offensive. And as we know, the Messines Wishart Ridge has the same impact from the German perspective. If they hold that ridge, they can interdict with their artillery the main logistic route into Ypres from Poperinge, the forward logistic base. And so on the 7th of June, that's when the New Zealand Division, as part of Godley's 2nd Anzac Corps, takes Messines as part of Plumer's 2nd Army taking the ridge. And that holds the shoulder for an offensive that starts on the 31st of July with Gough's 5th Army. Haig's first major mistake. Gough was his protege, and as we see, it's a problem. And so our objective, his objective, is to interdict that line, and from Passchendaele, it's all plain out, and you can initially, long range, 9.2, the heavy artillery can interdict that line. It's under observation. No matter what you think about it, that's the reason. Okay, and so Second Army is after Messines, which Haig regards as his greatest victory to that date. And there you have, you know, the blimpish General Plumer, who with Harrington as Chief of Staff are the superb tactical team on the Western Front. Haig himself and Herbert, it'll come back to me in a couple of minutes, and then I won't tell you. And what scale are we looking at? Because it's important not to just to focus on the New Zealand Division. It's one of 60 divisions, and it by itself can't change anything. It's how armies, corps work, and here we have Haig's five armies on the Western Front. The one we're interested in is Plumer, the blimpish chap we looked at, Second Army, and within that there are the two Anzac Corps, each corps usually numbering a number of divisions, usually four. And for this battle, you have four in one Anzac under Birdwood, which are the Australian divisions, and Godley, the commander of the New Zealand Expeditionary Force, commands one ANZAC, which has Russell's New Zealand Division, Monash's 3rd Australian Division, and for this battle, two British divisions, the 49th and the 66th Division, which join them just before the battle. And down there, we've got the New Zealand Division, and I mentioned the other divisions. And you see, a standard British division has three brigades, each of four battalions. But in 1917, New Zealand is the exception because it's the strongest division in the British Army. It's got four brigades. One is a compromise accepted by the New Zealand government to stop them having to raise a second division. Conscription's in place, and so you see the first three, the North Island, number one, South Island, number two, the Rifle Brigade, and the division that was raised at the beginning of 1917, the 4th Brigade, and as you'll see, the two battalions of the Auckland and the Wellington regiments are in the North Island Brigade, the 2nd Brigade, two battalions of the Canterbury's and the Otago's. The Rifle Brigade has four Rifle Brigade battalions, originally the Trentham Regiment, but Liverpool, the Governor General, decided that he would give it its name as because he's from the Rifles. And four brigade, one of each, Auckland, Wellington, Canterbury and Otago. And so they're the people who are going to do it. And it's a time of innovation and, in fact, tactical revolution after the Somme the previous year. And I need a volunteer to be Eep. And you're the man? Okay, there's Eep.
Boy, Bruce.
Just face that way so that... All right. Let's have a ring. This is the high ground. Okay, dominated by the Germans. And on 31st of July, Gough's 5th Army, and you're Gough's 5th Army.
Oh, pretty powerful.
And that's north, that's south. The good guys are on this side. The not so good guys are on that side to the east. All right. And the lovely lady here is Passion Day. And when I want you to, you'll step back a bit. All right, but you're right where you are now. Okay, and so essentially, having gained Messines on that shoulder, that secures the logistic resupply into Ypres and the British front line in front of it. And of course, they want to gain the high ground because from Passchendaele here, the Rulers Lane railway is about 12 to 15 kilometres away, in range of the heaviest artillery fire. But having gained that ground, Haig anticipated a further advance to interdict it and really stuff up the German logistics, because as we saw on that map, the next parallel railway line that the Germans control is the one that runs into Ostend. And if they take step back, there is no intervening high ground. It's all flat plain, almost at sea level. And so as a concept, as a strategic concept, and that's what it is, the plan makes sense. It's the execution where it all falls apart. And that's where it certainly falls apart in terms of
2nd Anzac Corps under Godwin. Now, if you look at what people say about the New Zealanders or the Anzacs at Passchendaele, it's a broad view. On one hand, Glynn, in his massacre at Passchendaele, sees the blame not at the Hague's level, but Plumer, Godley, and Russell. Andrew MacDonald, on his Passchendaele book, sees Godley as the principal culprit. And so, and because I was Andrew's supervisor, I tend to go that way too. However, so, and the debate continues. That's what makes it. And the emotion, when you read the diaries, floods in as well. And so, on the 31st of July, Gough attacks in the north at Langemak. And if you want to see a cemetery that has all the Tolkien reality of a Gothic wood with 60,000 Germans in mass graves, Langemak is a place you want to go to. And at Langemak, Gough's 5th Army comes at Gutzer. And as a perceptive Cyril Falls, who was a staff officer in the First World War, said, at Messines, we had a sense that we had won the battle at 0 hour. At Passchendaele, under Gough, we had a sense that we had lost the battle for the same reason. Lack of leadership, lack of planning, and yet this was an army that had assimilated the lessons of the Somme, had put together a tactical doctrine that moved you out of the waves, company strong waves of the Somme, attacking in line, down to a small group where a platoon commander and his 4 sections of 12 men were drilled and drilled again in small group fire and movement, because the Germans had moved away from the zigzag of trenches packed with one man a yard to a system whereby, if I can have you 4 gentlemen here out, if you come out this way, thanks. Alright, and just there, okay, and if you come, yeah, excellent. Now the Germans move to the concrete pillboxes, and if you go to Tynecott or the New Zealand Memorial at Messines, within the grounds you'll see samples of those pillboxes from the Western Front, and they were built to withstand the heaviest artillery, and they were not platforms to fight from, you know, the Saving Private Ryan, that machine gunner looking through, mowing down the Americans as they get off the beach. These were bunkers to secure the machine gun teams. And there would be, in some cases, 8 to 10 machine gun teams in each of these bunker complexes, usually based on the foundations of former farmhouses with the cellars, and built in situ, obviously, in ferro-concrete. And as soon as the artillery barrage lifted, these machine gun teams, bleeding from the ears, usually because of the duration of the barrage, we're going back out.
So thank you very much. Sorry for the inconvenience, but we're now clear to go back in the building.
I don't know what's going to happen next, but either way, I will do a short, sharp 20 minutes, so it'll allow some time for at least one question. Okay. And so, basically, the emphasis has shifted from company mass of 120 men down to a four-section platoon where now each man is trained in all the infantry weapons. Lewis gun, hand carry, rifle grenade, ideal for lobbing into trenches or shell holes, bombers, mill bomb, smoke bombs, and a very nasty phosphorus bomb, which superb in Passchendaele because you couldn't put it out, and you get it in, all the bunkers were dripping, and so very effective, and rifle and banged. And so, and reinforcements. Because of the New Zealand reinforcement system, they were perhaps the best trained infantry reinforcements in any army, because Featherston, Trentham, Ship, Sling, over to Etape, infantry in reserve, depot, then up to the divisional reinforcement unit, and then finally out to the battalions. It would take 10 months on average for a rifleman when he marches into Trentham camp to end up with his battalion at the front. Exception 1918, because they hurry them forward, but because of the German March offensive. So, the platoon and the section is everything. And, but I'm going to shoot through that because I'm, but there's Godley, there's Russell, and equal and opposite reaction. That's your, those four guys who didn't get a chance to star, and I apologize. That was what you were. And that, and if you can imagine, this is painted by Butler about 12 months after the Passchendaele. If you can imagine, there's still that straggly bit of barbed wire there. Those bunkers are surrounded by 25 to 50 metres of wire entanglement. And the gaps and the lanes and the open areas between those bunkers, if they're there, they're deliberate. That's the killing ground. That's where you get the sheep in and mow them down with those machine gun teams that we talked about. And there we are. Machine gun teams that would get out into the surrounding shell holes and use the wire to channel and kill. And picture a wave of men trying to advance up onto the high ground at the point where the Germans calculated that they ran out of the supporting 18-pounder field gun fire, and the guns would have stopped and have to move forward. At that point were the German reserves to counter it. And so the British counter to that was small group actions, platoons moving forward, taking out a piece of the jigsaw at a time, with within the battalion 3-inch mortars being carried forward to provide their close
support indirect fire because the other fire has to live. Does that make sense? Okay, let's move on. And I put that up. That's what I've just said, but I've used the 9th Scottish Division to remind you that this is not just the New Zealanders or the Anzacs or the good, you know, the people we think are the best. This is every division of the 60 divisions in the British Army. It's a common doctrine. And there's a photo of the platoon handbook, and there you see a series of worms. If that's a worm, 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 that's a worm. NCO in front, platoon commander, platoon sergeant, and they're coming forward in file, hit opposition. Each worm acts independently. The gun group and one of the rifle groups here go to ground, fire the rifle grenades, are bombarding the bunker or the trench or the shell holes where they are, and another section is whipping around the side or the back, coming in, bombing, bayoneting, securing and moving on. And so there's 100 different battles occurring. And of course you practice, rehearse, because it, and that, this is going to be online, isn't it? Joe, you can go back and see, go look at the detail of this, but creeping barrage, infantry, battalion organization, platoon fire movement, and bite and hold attacks. Take it to the edge of what our artillery can support, with 1,000 meters beyond that to whack them when they try and counterattack, and that's the process. And it's well practiced, and it's successful. Gough fails. I'll use this as, there we are. There's our high ground and our arc with Passchendaele out here. And Gough is unlucky, but he deserves to be. But the soldiers he commanded didn't. Attacks in the north, Langemark, and combination of the weather and rushed planning lends to failure. And so on the 18th of August, 2nd Army under Plumer is pushed in. And this is where, on the 4th of October, the New Zealanders get involved. And so Plumer's 2nd Army comes in on the 20th September and will fight it through until the Canadian Corps finally take Passchendaele in early November. And so, and they're attacking in the centre, and to the south on the right, and bite and hold, and they are successful. And one Anzac as really the focus is very successful on the 20th September in the Battle of Menin Road. And this is high-tech infantry and combined arms. Tanks, communication tanks, filled with radio to let brigade and division know progress. Spotter aircraft and close support aircraft overhead. And these bite and hold attacks work. 26th of September, Polygon Wood, again, one Anzac. And for the first time, really, the AIF start living up to the legend. I'll get into great trouble, but they can't come after me because they can't leave New South Wales, so we're okay. And finally, oh, there we are, let's keep going. And then in the centre,
that's where we get involved in early October. But the danger of all of this is because we haven't grabbed the left, or,
yeah, that's the left, the north,
we're advancing into the apex of the triangle. And now, increasingly, German artillery from north and south and east can zero in on a narrowing front. Does that make sense? Okay. And that's Gough's swan song. I mentioned Menin Road. And, wow, this is not just the Australians. This is an 8-kilometre front of 4 British corps and averaging 15,000 men a division. So, big numbers. And Polygon Wood, same thing again. Great reading. And there are more divisions involved, but I simply ran out of map. And there's the New Zealanders. Early October, in training for the front to take their turn. And you don't have the massive rehearsals that you see before Messines, but for the previous 3 weeks, they've been practicing the tactics at battalion, company, and platoon level. And they know what's expected of them, and the onus is on the junior leadership. And Bob, basically, we're going to see 2 attacks. 4th, Glavenstaffel, where the New Zealand monument is. It's the only time in the war that the 2 Anzac Corps and the divisions of those corps fight side by side. New Zealand Division against Gravenstaffel, the 3rd Monash's 3rd Australian Division on its right against Tynecott, and then to its right again the Australian divisions of 1 Anzac Corps, and on the left the New Zealand Division is on the corps boundary. You've got I think it's 18th Corps on that side. And so, 4th, outstanding success, and Haig gets really excited at this point because the Germans have lost 2 battles to bite and hold attacks, and so they repack the front line. And they're going to do a spoiling attack, which is preempted by 20 minutes with our opening barrage, which falls at 0 hour. And as the New Zealanders are going and the Australians are going forward, all the shell holes are full of dead and wounded Germans. And if you ever get the chance to walk Gravenstaffel, it's a great battle to walk because you can stand on Dohy Farm Cemetery and survey the entire battlefield. And if I had more time, I'd wax eloquent, but I won't. And so that's a success. Haig wants to put in the cavalry and pressures Plumer and Godley, who's keen, because Birdwood, who he sees as his great rival, has won 2 battles in a row. Godley has got a nice red star for Messines, and now if he's ever going to be considered for an army, now's the time to show Haig that he's his man. And on the 8th, they attack successfully on the 4th, moderate casualties. On the 6th, the New Zealand Division is replaced by the 49th Division, and Godley makes a point of telling Plumer and Haig
that he doesn't want any delay, even though the rain is pissing down. And there's only one supply route, and it's been churned up by the 300 guns that have to be taken forward. And if you think that 180-pounder, which we'll see shortly, takes 250 men from the pioneers or nearby infantry and three horse teams to drag it forward. But what about 300 rounds minimum of ammunition for each gun and the heavy railway sleepers that you need as bedding to stop the guns sinking into the mud? And all that logistics is a core problem. But Haig has said, be ready for the breakthrough when the attack goes in on the 9th. Move up your Anzac regiments and have reserve divisions, the New Zealanders and Australians having a brigade near a train station ready to exploit forward when the Germans crack. And that preoccupies Godley. The fact that it's raining and continues to rain means that the day before the 9th, when these two British divisions are supposed to attack, Haig realizes that the exploitation phase is not going to happen in the mud. But Godley hasn't got the guns forward and hasn't allowed for the fact that one infantryman is going to take 4 hours to walk a mile at night carrying his 60 pounds of kit. And so on the 9th, the two British divisions with flanking divisions are late, miss what artillery support there is, and are cut down by the German machine guns. But Godley, from the garbled reports that come back to him, tells Haig it's been an outstanding success and all the objectives have been gained. Oops. So, the next morning, when it becomes clear that they're still on their start line with heavy casualties, he has to go back to Haig, and in Haig's diary, if you see an exclamation mark at the end of the sentence, you know he's not happy. But if you see two at the end of the sentence, he's really pissed off. And so Haig says it seems that progress has not been as much as reported yesterday. One exclamation mark. Godley realizes that his dreams of being an army commander are slipping away, and so he tells Haig that Monash and Russell have promised to raise an Australian flag over Passchendaele. And of course, and they don't want any delay or postponement. This is Godley making these decisions. It's not something he's discussing. And at this point, his engineer and his artillery advisor are tearing their hair out because there's only one road forward and it's been torn up by the guns. And so that successful battle at Brudensien, we're going, how are we doing? There we are, and there we are. We can look at two at once. Front line, 4th of October, Grabenstaffel Ridge, the line of that road, and it's a banana, and it's interesting, it's called the Heights of Abraham. It's an ideal defensive line against Germans attacking from the east, and it was the line held,
by the Canadians defending against the German attacks in 1915. And so if you had to stop because of the weather, that will be the ideal place to stop and consolidate. Because after that, you've got this angle of Bellevue Spur going out to Passchendaele and then coming back to Tynecott. And really, Passchendaele, unless you hold all of this, isn't tenable by itself. But that's what we end up with when the Canadians take it. And so if you want to be sensible, rebuild, organize, because it's the end of the fighting season, once you've taken that, and we take it very easily, that's the logical place to stop. But Haig, having been given this great victory, is intent on pushing on. And Corrick on Grevenstafel Ridge, looking towards Bellevue Spur, and you see the pimples on the skyline. That's what you're fighting on, and that's how it looks in dry weather. Throw in the rain, and you can imagine what it's like. And today, there's Grevenstafel Ridge with the New Zealand Memorial, and the New Zealanders, everywhere you see a building, picture bunkers at the time, because they've rebuilt the houses practically in the same location. And so if you're sitting on that ridge looking this way, ideal defences. And once you've got Grevenstafel, our front line is that line of buildings there, and you're looking at Bellevue Spur, which is the next objective. And Godley, despite the rain, despite the failure on the 9th, pushes for the New Zealanders and Australians, who have never failed him, to go on again. And the New Zealanders come in on the 10th, and it's going to, and if you can imagine, 15,000 men moving forward up that one road onto the duckboards while the guns are trying to get into position. And the fact is that it's all too rushed, because Godley has taken the objectives he didn't get on the 9th, added it to the ones he was going to give on the 12th, and he's asking the New Zealanders and Monash's Australians to get to Passchendaele in one hit on the 12th. And of course, Travis, who works as a divisional scout, Travis VC, goes up on the 11th and reports back that the wire hasn't been cut. And as we know, 12th of October, worst day in New Zealand history. And we die in the Radbeck in that swamp there. And as I mentioned, it takes until the 14th to clear the wounded. And Haig still persists, and now he's at the bottom of the hill, not back at Grevenstafel, but the opportunity is still there to consolidate, and he brings in the Canadians under Curry, and they mount four attacks, 17,000 casualties, and finally get Passchendaele, which they and everyone else, including Plumer and Haig, although he won't admit it, is untenable. And so it's interesting. If you look at Terry Kinloch's Godley, Glenn Harper's Dark Journey, including Massacre at Passchendaele,
Andrew MacDonald's Passchendaele and my Anzac experience. And one I forgot to bring, Ian McGibbon's very good book on the New Zealanders on the Western Front. Where is the failure? Russell said, had the wire been cut, he felt his men could have taken the pillboxes, because that's what they were trained to do, but to fight both wire and machine guns without artillery support is too much. And so he said, the fault is mine and my division on his front. And in these days of parliamentary questions, that is the picture. Godley, inviting to Allen, the Minister of Defence, paints a different story. Success on the 4th, moderate success on the 12th. And so when you average it out, it wasn't too bad. Except 2,400 casualties, 840 dead on the 12th alone. If you were to say who's at fault, both Russell, Johnston, his artillery commander, and his engineer continually pester Godley's corps for improvements to the road and gun support. The irony of the artillery support on the 12th is that when it falls, because of there's no base to the guns, they sink and the rounds fall short and land on the New Zealanders in their assembly areas. King, one of Russell's outstanding commanding officers, and was is killed, former commander of the Pioneer Battalion. The mortar rounds that they've carried up are hit by our fire and explode, and as the barrage goes forward, it vanishes because there's simply not enough guns and not enough rounds. When Curry comes in and takes over with his Canadian Corps, he insists on time to bring the guns up, to get the engineer support done, and after 17,000 casualties, he succeeds. If there is a blame, it's Haig not recognising the realities. It's Godley. Godley pushes after Birdwood, Gough, and Plumer have their doubts, but if the Corps commander is prepared to do it, they accept it, yet his Corps headquarters don't provide the logistics and the backing that the infantryman needs to succeed. Russell is totally honest, and in fact, his letter to Allen on the 7th of November is the first time in any war that I've seen a general say, the buck stops with me. Thank you very much.
As Newfoundland ends.
Thanks, Chris. I don't know that we've got time for questions at this point.